This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is now 1 p.m. Stay tuned for Leonard Lopate at Large coming up.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Last October, the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report that predicts we have 12 years to drastically scale back greenhouse emissions before catastrophic climate change will become inevitable. Our planet appears to be rushing toward a tipping point at which global systems will be pushed into a hothouse state, leading to temperature rises of up to 5 degrees and sea level rises of up to 197 feet. Some places, most notably Sweden, Iceland, Norway, France, South Korea, and Ontario, Canada, have successfully instituted policies that have replaced fossil fuels with low-carbon energy sources in just 1 to 2 decades, and those solutions are the subject of a new book from Public Affairs called A Bright Future. Joining us now are its authors, Joshua Goldstein, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University, and Stefan Kvist, a Swedish engineer, scientist, and consultant to clean energy projects around the world. Welcome to our show.
Hi. Thank you very much. Hi.
You have received rave blurbs from all over the political spectrum, including climate scientist James Hansen, the former head of NASA Goddard Institute, who's been a key figure in the history of concerns about global warming, but also two Republicans, former Secretary of State George P. Schultz and the former head of the EPA, Christine Todd Whitman. But hasn't this become a political issue?
No, it's not politicized for those who care about climate change. Now, climate change itself is pretty political, but for Republicans or Democrats who care about climate change and know that it's real, when you do the math, there is simply no way to decarbonize the world by 2050, which is what we need to do, without using nuclear power. And this is becoming increasingly clear, and we know that it works from Sweden's experience and other countries, as you mentioned.
And we'll get to that in a moment. Perhaps the most powerful endorsement of your book is Steven Pinker's opening sentence in his foreword. He writes, "Few books can certifiably claim to offer a way to save the world." But this one does. Do we really have only a dozen years to turn things around?
Yes, we need to act really fast. And this is the thing that James Hansen and other climate scientists have been telling us, that not only do we need to do an enormous thing, which is replace the 85% of energy we're getting from fossil fuels, but we need to do it really fast, because every pound of carbon dioxide that goes up there is warming up the planet more. That's why nuclear power is so important, because it's so concentrated, it can scale up really quickly, and that's what Sweden and these other places did.
But it would require implementing fundamental changes to the ways that we run our economies and societies, even past just implementing nuclear power.
Not necessarily that dramatic. I think that's one of the key points of our book, that this was done quite undramatically. It didn't have such a disruptive impact on the economies of Sweden and France to decarbonize using this method. And I think that's the main argument, that this has actually been done at the scale relative and at the speed that would be required going forward. That has actually been done in history. And that's kind of an easy finding to make, but it's not very well publicized. So that's one of the things we try to get out with this book.
And in Sweden, it was there was transitioning away from the use of fossil fuels pretty early, 1970 to 1990. So that means the discussion in Sweden began years before James Hansen sounded the alarm in 1988 and Margaret Thatcher called for a global treaty on climate change.
Yeah, I mean, the discussion at that point certainly wasn't about climate change at all in Sweden. It was more of an energy security issue. Sweden doesn't have any fossil fuel resources whatsoever. We do have abundant hydropower, but to cover the increase in energy demand that we had, we basically were at the moment we had to choose between probably going oil or coal or other fossil fuels imported, or developing our own power source, a new power source that will be nuclear power.
But it
and
was,
thankfully for the climate, that was the decision that was taken.
But it was a political one as well. Wasn't the policy instituted by a coalition of left and center parties?
It's kind of a complicated mixed model. So the first commercial nuclear power plant that was built in Sweden was built by a private company, ordered by a private utility, not state in either side. But then, of course, the state power utility went in and built the majority of the remaining reactors. So it was a bit of a mixed model, actually.
Last week, Stephen Pinker also writes in your book that people resist the reality of human-made climate change not because they are scientifically ignorant, but because they associate the claim with the political left and with communitarian and puritanical values regarding modern life with which they do not sympathize. Is that why influential people, including the President of the United States, continue to claim that climate change is a hoax?
Yeah, that took over the debate some years ago about climate change. The odd thing is that although Americans are completely divided about climate change, if you use that language, there's actually a great consensus about clean energy. So a lot of Republicans like clean energy sources. A lot of Republicans and Democrats like nuclear power, especially new innovative things that are coming along. But if you say climate change, then it's like Al Gore, and anything Al Gore is for, I'm against, or vice versa. And that's very unfortunate for the debate. We're trying to, with this book, present more of the facts, what we have to do to solve climate change, what scientists tell us, not so much about whether climate change is real. We may not convince the president of that, but how we can get our arms around the problem, how we could actually solve it.
But there's so much resistance. Last week, the Trump administration proposed major changes to the way the federal government calculates the benefits in human health and safety of restricting mercury emissions from coal-burning power plants. The Environmental Protection Agency issued a finding that federal rules imposed on mercury by the Obama administration are too costly to justify, and it changed the formula the government uses in its analysis of the regulation by taking into account only certain effects that can be measured in dollars while ignoring or playing down other health benefits. And the National Mining Association welcomed the move. They called mercury limits punitive and massively unbalanced.
Well,
I think anything
ahead,
we do to... Oh, sorry, Joshua, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, anything we do today to support coal power specifically is borderline or maybe even complete insanity, even from a purely economical standpoint. And it's a harder case to do from just pure economics about natural gas, possibly, but supporting coal in any way, if you include the externalities, the cost that the society pays, not directly on an electricity bill, but that's the total cost of this power generation, it just doesn't make any economical sense.
You wanted to add to
in
that,
America,
Joshua?
Yeah, in America, we're replacing coal with natural gas because it's cheaper, and coal's kind of on the way out. Americans may not realize that coal is still the dominant fuel in the world for generating electricity, and the fastest growing energy source in the 21st century. There's a lot of new coal plants being built around the world in poorer countries that want electricity. And yet the health consequences are quite dramatic. Something like 1 million people a year die as a result of emphysema and cancer and all this stuff from coal smoke, including in the United States, more than 10,000 people every year. So, that's all in addition to the effect of coal in putting carbon into the atmosphere, which it's the prime cause of. So we would have a big dilemma if the thing that were bad for our health and were dangerous was the thing that would clean up the atmosphere, but it's exactly the opposite. Coal is dangerous, it's deadly, it's not the cheapest thing out there either, and it's the thing that's causing global warming. So coal is kind of job one here to get that off the grid globally.
Wasn't there talk of clean coal some years back? Have we given up on that one?
Yes. Clean coal was kind of coal with the word clean put in front of it by the coal industry. is about what it amounted to. There were efforts to capture the carbon before it went into the atmosphere from coal plants, and some billions of dollars were put into that, and it just didn't work. It wasn't economical, and at this point is not feasible.
What about natural gas? You brought that up, but you say in the book natural gas isn't clean fuel.
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's everything compared to coal is more or less clean, but compared to clean, natural gas is extremely dirty. It's a very it's a large source of greenhouse gas emissions, of course, but also other emissions. It's just the only comparison you can make where natural gas is clean is if you compare it to coal. Of course, we have much cleaner energy sources that we could use. So certainly not, no.
But beyond coal, there are other fossil fuels that create problems. And there are any number of countries that rely, their economies are pretty much based on fossil fuels. Nigeria, Venezuela, Russia.
Sure. Those are the exporting countries. And then countries like India, Indonesia, Turkey, you know, they burn coal to power their economies. And I think it's important for Americans to realize that a poor farmer in India is not going to stop burning coal or refuse to get on the electric grid because it's powered by coal unless there's something more affordable and more practical. So you can't just tell everybody in poor countries don't use fossil fuels, because we richer countries have used up the world's carbon budget when we got rich. That's not going to work. We have to have practical alternatives for them.
But we all have to live on the same planet.
That's right. And whatever the United States does with our carbon emissions is not going to have the biggest effect on the whole problem, because China's carbon emissions are way higher than ours, and these other countries are coming on strong. So most of the problem in the upcoming 30 years is actually going to be driven by other parts of the world. What America can do is to lead on innovation and create solutions that can then work worldwide.
Did you think there would be a major shift in attitudes here after Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth was released?
Well, attitudes shift slowly, so I don't know. I think that, what's happening is there's an accumulation of evidence now that climate change is really dire, that we're not on track. The world is not on track to solve it. And the Paris Agreement would not get us to where we need to get to, and the countries are not keeping their commitments under the Paris Agreement. We've spent $2 trillion on renewables in the last decade, and carbon emissions haven't gone down at all. So we're just seriously not on track. We need to look at some of these options that we might have not looked at earlier.
But on the positive side, I would say that the discussion is getting better and better every day. I mean, there's more and more truth. There's more and more facts in the general discussion about different energy sources, about the climate issue. So in that sense, things are on a positive arc, I would say. We're certainly not there yet, but at least we don't have to be all gloomy, because that the discussion is getting much better day by day, I think.
Well, Stefan, you went to school here in the United States, but you know, you're from Sweden. So you've seen both sides of this debate.
Yeah, I was in hippie central United States in Berkeley, California, where it's kind of a parallel universe where it's a very prominent nuclear science institution in a place that is very heavily anti-nuclear.
I'm speaking with Stefan A. Kvist and Joshua S. Goldstein, co-authors of a book called A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. So Sweden replaced coal power plants with nuclear plants, and then slowly integrated renewable energy alongside it. And as a result, during that time period, didn't Sweden generate more electricity than ever and see its economy grow by 50%?
Yeah, so Sweden, the story of Sweden is a little bit more complicated than that. It was mainly that the Swedish economy was growing very quickly. And up until, let's say, about 1965, the Swedish emissions were growing even quicker than the economy. So Sweden was no better than anyone else, if you plot those two things out. And then Sweden turned to its nuclear program on a pretty short time period, built a number of plants that today, from then until today, produce about half of the electricity in the country. And the second half is from hydroelectric power, which means that there's essentially no greenhouse gas emissions from the electricity system in Sweden.
Well, hydroelectric power is not available to many countries simply because of their geographies. But let's talk about what your book is largely a defense of nuclear power as an alternative. Aren't there good reasons to be wary of relying too much on nuclear energy, as we've seen in a number of disasters, including Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, Fukushima?
Well, it's a kind of getting to the point where the debate has shifted on that, because Three Mile Island, as is well known today, in terms of an accident, is not much of an accident. I mean, you didn't have anyone hurt, no one died. So in terms of an industrial accident, it wouldn't rank anywhere at all. Of course, Chernobyl is a kind of a special case that takes a while to get into. But again, Fukushima kind of proved that point. Again, you had what could be referred to as an act of God, a massive earthquake, tsunami, 20,000 people dead, critical infrastructure of all types destroyed, hydroelectric power dams destroyed, oil facilities destroyed. And again, no one died from radiation. So just a hard look at the numbers wouldn't cause anyone to really fear the safety record of nuclear. And that, I think, is starting to get out there. I mean, people are starting to realize these are the facts. Well, so I see a positive shift on that issue.
Well, actually, people have died from radiation. In September, Japan confirmed the first Fukushima worker's death from radiation. Others have sued over cancer. In the case of radiation, death isn't always an immediate thing. We saw something similar here with 9/11. Some people died immediately after the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center, but many others have come down with serious illnesses over the years since, and there have been quite a few deaths.
Right. I mean, it's the death that was attributed to Fukushima is say, highly contested. It was a man with lung cancer, and there's really no way to causally link that. But even so, everything, and I think this is one of the things we really want to stress, everything has its pros and cons. Everything has a negative side and a positive side. And the only way we can make good decisions is if we look at all the negatives, which we really do as a society in nuclear, but also all the positives. But we also have to apply the same standard to everything else. And when you do that, things can just be safe or not safe in relation to other things. They're not absolutely safe or not. So if you apply a completely safe standard to anything, it won't be possible to do. You can't have cars if you have a zero tolerance for any accidents or airplanes or anything else in society. So what we're trying to stress is basically to look at things in relation to each other.
It has been revealed that radiation has drifted across the Pacific and has actually come to the United States as well. And there are concerns that the radiation from Fukushima has affected the food supply.
I can categorically tell you that it absolutely has no effect on the food supply in the U.S. We can detect radiation at very small levels, but of course you have radiation in your body right now. A normal banana emits radiation from the potassium-40 inside of it. And so the fact that we can detect it doesn't necessarily mean it has any kind of impact on health or safety, which is the case with any of the radiation that could migrate from Fukushima to here. It's all a factor of how much it is, and the levels can be detected at extremely small levels, but at levels that have absolutely no impact on you, and that are or many orders of magnitude lower than you would just get from normal life.
It's also
Can I jump in on this Fukushima issue, because think about what we're talking about here, that the fourth worst earthquake in history killed 20,000 people. And then we're talking about whether maybe one or maybe zero people died from radiation, and that maybe a few people may die from cancer decades down the line. And the World Health Organization, the UN, and everybody went in and did a very careful, thorough study of this. And their best answer is approximately zero. But yeah, it's possible somebody might die, and maybe this one guy's cancer had, so let's say it had something to do with Fukushima. But side by side with that, a million people a year are dying from coal. Coal that could be taken off the grid if we would get off over our fears about nuclear power and radiation. Radiation is in the air all the time in our lives. The background radiation is something like 3 millisieverts per year. And if you live at Denver, that goes up to 5. And if you live in Ramsar, Iran, it goes up to 200. And there's no health effects that have been found in any of these variations. So the industrial limit that they put, this is for nuclear and elsewhere, is 50.
Why is it so high in Iran?
Radium springs in that place. Oh. There's radium springs, and there's beaches in Brazil. There's various of these hot spots. So that's all been studied. But they've set a conservative limit of 50 millisieverts a year for industrial exposure. And nobody in the general public in Japan, much less on the other side of the Pacific, got that much radiation. So it's actually a story about how successful and safe nuclear power is, because this tremendous natural disaster happened, and it didn't, and the nuclear plant didn't kill anybody. So you can study the safety, the number of deaths per kilowatt hour generated, and nuclear is 400 times less than coal. And yet we talk about, you know, maybe somebody died and maybe some tiny amount of radiation went across the Pacific. It's kind of crazy. It's so out of scale.
An interesting detail is that the 2020 Olympics, which will be in Japan, the torches will be made of recycled aluminum from Fukushima. Did you know that?
No. I did not know that, no.
There are other matters of concern about using nuclear power plants. How to dispose of nuclear waste and concerns about nuclear proliferation, and also the threat of nuclear terrorism. You deal with these things in your book, but I think that we really should discuss them. And nuclear waste has been a major problem. Nobody seems to know where to put it in this country. Aren't they just storing it in some caves?
Yeah, so I think from my perspective, knowing quite a lot about this from studying and researching, I think the nuclear waste issue is probably the most misunderstood issue in all of energy and climate science debates of all topics. It's actually quite staggering. When I first got to see a nuclear waste storage facility, this is the place where they store all of Sweden's used nuclear fuel from powering half of the country for 40 years. It's basically a large swimming pool, a deep, large swimming pool, and you can go there and you can visit it and you can stand next to it. And it's really the most benign thing. You'd think you have mountains of green liquid cans leaking. No, it's absolutely staggeringly benign, this problem. And so we have so many misconceptions about things like half-lives or how long something is dangerous. If you have a chemical waste that's dangerous, it doesn't have a half-life. It's dangerous forever. You would have to store it away from people in the biosphere forever. Nuclear waste has half-lives, which means it gets less dangerous with time. But that's, you know, it's not, it's a misunderstood question. Right?
Well, it gets less dangerous really over millions of years.
Yes, sure. But chemical wastes from other processes that we produce in the thousands and tens of thousands of tons are dangerous effectively forever. So it's just a matter of, if you really take a hard look at what's dangerous that the society is producing and how long you have to store that away from human, nuclear waste is not that different.
What about nuclear proliferation and nuclear terrorism, which are major concerns?
Let me say something more about the waste, and then I want to get to the proliferation issue.
Okay.
The waste is such a tiny problem because nuclear power is so concentrated. If you take a pound of coal and turn it into electricity, you can power your house for about an hour. And if that were uranium powering nuclear power, you could power your house for 2 years. So it's just tremendously more concentrated, a million times more concentrated than coal. And the same thing's true at the other end. Coal waste is these vast quantities that are thrown into slurries behind big dams. And the nuclear waste is really tiny amounts. They're put on in dry casks out behind the nuclear plants now in the United States, and they're good for 100 years there. They've never hurt anybody. They haven't caused any problem. And so, as Stefan says, this is a greatly overhyped issue. Now, on the proliferation issue, also overhyped because people confuse nuclear weapons with nuclear power. Nuclear weapons are very bad, and nuclear power is good. So they're not the same. They don't work the same, although they both involve nuclear fission. So,
well, where do you get the nuclear ingredients for proliferation? You get them from the nuclear waste?
No. Nobody gets nuclear weapons material, which would be plutonium and fissionable uranium, from civilian nuclear power plants. The places, in fact, a couple of the most problematic countries like North Korea and Israel that have made or are making nuclear weapons don't even have civilian nuclear power plants. It's not an efficient way to make plutonium. Countries like Pakistan that make their own plutonium do it in their own separate reactors that are dedicated to that purpose. And it's not an easy thing to do. Taking nuclear material from a civilian nuclear plant and turning it into weapons would be extremely unlikely and difficult. What we have in the world is a system of controls run through the International Atomic Energy Agency that prevent the diversion of nuclear material. So we have inspectors, we have cameras, and all this stuff to prevent a country that thought they could take civilian nuclear power material and eventually concentrate it and turn it into weapons. They can't do that because this system that almost every country in the world is part of.
And uranium mining is not a dangerous pursuit?
I think this goes back to our point about relative risks. I mean, all mining is fraught with danger. Uranium mining, parts of uranium mining, which is in situ leaching, is quite, it's very safe because it doesn't really involve human miners. But all mining has difficulties. All you need to mine a lot of material for any type of energy production. And mining has dangers associated with it, but it's really no different than any other type of mining.
So why do you think a number of states have closed down their nuclear power plants? And the areas, the people who live near the plants have been seriously concerned.
The people who live near nuclear power plants are the most supportive of nuclear power. All the polling shows that. The closer you live and the more you understand it, the more supportive you are. The reason that nuclear power plants are closing down is really simple. It's because we have a lot of cheap natural gas in the United States. We don't charge anything for the carbon pollution and the global warming effect that it has. So companies like Entergy that own nuclear power plants also own twice as many fossil fuel plants. And for them to decide, do I keep this nuclear power plant running or do I go to a cheaper natural gas plant, which, by the way, is also regulated much more lightly and causes less political upset and lawsuits and all that stuff. So they switch over and they go to natural gas. It's fine for them as a private company, but it's why carbon emissions go up. In New England, we closed a plant a few years ago, the Vermont Yankee plant, and carbon emissions had been going down in New England for a decade, and then they started going up again because it was replaced with natural gas. Now I'm going to close another one this year in Massachusetts, and the same thing will happen.
How many nuclear plants remain in operation in the United States? Do we know?
Yeah, it's about 100. We actually have more nuclear plants here than any other country. You don't hear about them because they're running safely without incident, day in, day out. And we generate about one-fifth of United States electricity with nuclear power.
But one should add to that number, that's about, more than 60% of the clean power in the United States. So it's the dominant clean electricity source in the United States and in Europe, actually.
I'm speaking with Joshua S. Goldstein and Stefan A. Kvist, Q-V-I-S-T, about their book, A Bright Future, which is published by Public Affairs. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, in and broadcasting from Times Square. One day in a new period, they may understand our rage. Build machines that they can't control and bury the waste in a great big hole. Powers to become cheap and clean. Grimy faces were never seen. Deadly. We're back with our guests, Joshua S. Goldstein and Stefan, S-T-A-F-F-A-N, Aikvist, author of A Bright Future, which is published by Public Affairs. Joshua, you're a professor of international relations at American University. You've written 6 books about war, peace, diplomacy, and economic history, college textbook on international relations. Clean energy projects are Stefan's specialty. How did you come to co-author this book?
Well, I've had an interest in world energy dynamics ever since the 1970s. But back then, I was a California hippie, and I was against nuclear power. What happened is that I had kids, and then my son, when he was about 10 years old, turned into a climate activist. And when he got to be about 20 years old, he said, everybody should drop what they're doing and work on climate change. It's that important. This is his generation speaking. And I said, you know, you're right. And I study global trends. I study world governance issues. And so this fits into my interests in that way. So I started to look, without any preconceptions or agenda, at what it would actually take to really stop climate change from destroying the planet and leave a good world for my son. And it quickly becomes clear, if you do the math, that you can't do that without nuclear power. And then I found Stefan's work on what Sweden had done and other countries. And so I asked him if he would collaborate on this to get the word out to the public about this topic. That's how it happened.
And Stefan, you, as you said earlier, you were trained as a nuclear energy engineer at UC Berkeley. So you must be fully aware of all of the obstacles in this country to what you and Joshua are proposing in this book.
Yeah, I mean, this is by no means an easy problem to tackle in whatever way we choose to do it. I mean, anyone who tells you that this will be easy and pain-free, I think, are deluding themselves. This is a difficult problem to tackle. What came out of my kind of, if you even call it research, just looking at what other countries had done across the world, this data is available, just looking, have we ever done what we need to do? And have we ever done it quick enough, and where and how? When you run that data for the first time, I think the people who have done that now all have to go back and relook at the numbers, because they cannot believe what's popping out. I mean, from media, you would think that Germany's amazing solar and wind program would be the leading star in that, maybe wind power in Denmark. But they don't show up. I mean, you can't see those programs in the graphs. The fastest low-carbon electricity expansions that we've seen, the top 10, top 15, depending on how you normalize, have all been nuclear programs. Germany's nuclear program beat Germany's current wind and solar program. And I had no idea about this when I first ran the data. I didn't even believe the numbers that came out. But then I started, you know, to believe it when I really double-checked it. And I started to publish scientific articles about it. The problem is that very few people read them. And so I was really happy when Joshua came along and said, we need to write a book about this so that, you know, people who don't read scientific articles actually can see this data and make up their own minds.
Now, Sweden also made a major commitment to wind, solar, and hydroelectric power. But you're saying that's just a drop in the bucket?
Hydroelectric is certainly not. I mean, it's kind of the obvious power choice for any country that has those resources available. If you have big rivers or big lakes with elevation differences in between them, you will build hydro.
And the United States has Niagara Falls, for example, which provides a fair amount of electricity for the Northeast.
Right. So the United States has amazing hydro facilities, but very little room for expansion. So there isn't, you can't tap into that source in the U.S. to cover what fossil fuels are providing today. You could expand it a little bit, but you would certainly have environmental protest against that. But even if you did that and went up against those protests, that the increase in hydropower that you could get in the U.S. is actually a drop in the bucket. And so you'd need to go to something else for that.
And wind and solar are really ineffective?
No. I mean, it really depends on where you look. I mean, we have to have a systematic approach. If we want to decarbonize electricity and then power with electricity, things that are currently not powered by electricity, we need to look at the full system and how it works together. And so in Texas, for instance, where you have excellent resource for wind and solar, those will be an important part of a decarbonized electricity system. In New York, where you live, they will be less important because the conditions are not right. But all of the modeling that is being done and reported to and summarized by the IPCC, and actually all of the real-world examples that we have, indicate that nuclear, in a really decarbonized world, where you really have very low emissions from your electricity system, nuclear will play an important part. Now, I can't tell you exactly how much because it depends on the local conditions and where prices go. But there's no modeling being done fairly for a very low emission system that doesn't include a significant portion of nuclear.
Since Sweden and a number of other countries have had great success in this area, why do you think more European countries, you mentioned Germany, haven't implemented similar policies?
Well, Germany kind of did to begin with. I mean, Western Germany built, as I said, their nuclear program was more successful than their current wind and solar program. But of course, they have a deeply rooted skepticism towards nuclear. And there are many psychological studies about why that may be. I mean, certainly there's a lot of misinformation out there, but there's also a very deeply rooted negative attitude, which might have to do with a Cold War kind of confusion regarding what is a nuclear weapon and what is a nuclear civilian peaceful nuclear power plant.
And I'd imagine Japan has similar misgivings, although Japan did have nuclear power plants.
Yeah, Japan is trying really hard now to restart all of their nuclear power plants that they had to shut down after Fukushima, because they've seen not only the impact on the extremely negative impact on their economy by having to import fossil fuels at a massive scale, but also actual environmental and pollution damage from having to burn a lot more fossil fuels. So they are really trying to restart their shuttered nuclear plants, and some of them have gone back online.
What about Russia, which relies on fossil fuel sales to support much of its economy, and some of the other big economies of the world, India and China? Why aren't they moving toward nuclear power if you think that that's the best solution?
Well, we are trying to make this argument because not everyone is so far agreeing with us. So that's partially why we read the book and are joining you here today. China has quite ambitious plans. I think absolutely not ambitious enough for nuclear, and the same with India. But they do have a plan to go nuclear, let's say. Just they are insufficiently ambitious, I think, for climate.
In both of those countries, you have cities that have so much pollution that people have to wear masks sometimes just to walk through the streets. But won't it be necessary for every country in the world to join in the effort for us to avert the disaster predicted in just a dozen years from now?
Not really.
Yeah.
We might have different opinions.
Okay, I want you to disagree. You first, Stefan.
Yeah, everyone should join in, but it's relative to the size of your economy and your energy consumption, how much you need to join in. So I would never say that all of the world's nations need to build nuclear power plants. That would be an insane plan. We need a few key places to decarbonize. And if you're a very poor nation that uses very little energy today Your climate impact is so small that we really don't have an historical moral justification and really no acute need for them to decarbonize that tiny energy consumption. There's a few key places where this needs to happen.
Are hydroelectric plants being built in Africa, where there are some really powerful rivers? And, of course, you have both the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean for the coastal countries.
Yes. I mean, there is a significant hydroelectric component of many African nations' grids. It's sometimes a dominant component. So, as I said, this is kind of the no-brainer go-to power source. It's usually the cheapest. If you have a good amount of water, it's a very stable and easily ramping up and down power source. But it does have its own environmental impact locally, at least. So one of the reasons Sweden built nuclear, one of the main reasons, actually, apart from energy security, is that we wanted to protect rivers from hydropower plants.
Because what kind of effect does it have on a river?
Well, you have to dam up the river. So you have to put a big slab of concrete across the river to put turbines in to produce power. And so the natural flow of the river is completely disrupted.
Joshua?
So Stefan is right that there's a few places that are very important, especially China at the top of the list, India, United States. The reason I said yes about everybody being part of it is that I'm the global trends guy, and I'm thinking that we need to solve the problem sort of from the top down in the totality. And we've had this problem so far. The Paris Agreement's a good example of it, where we let each country come and say what they can do, and it's all steps in the right direction. We'll put in more solar here, and we'll dam up these rivers over there. And the trouble is that it's not adding up. So what we really need to ask is how can we really decarbonize by 2050? That's a huge undertaking, and that's what the climate scientists tell us to do. So what would actually work in doing that? And then you see that we need a kind of a world program of switching over from fossil fuel to clean energy sources. Now, if you dam up all the rivers you can and you build all the solar cells that you can and put in all the wind you can, all these, you know, sort of popular things that are not nuclear power, you only get about halfway there. Part of the problem here is that today's grid is a small part of the electricity we'll need in 30 years from now. Today's grid is growing. New people are coming on the grid in the hundreds of thousands every day. Countries are using more electricity. That's one piece of it. And then we're going to need to do things like electrify transportation, electric cars. Those need electricity. Things like using electricity instead of coal for steel mills and industry. And we're going to need eventually to suck carbon out of the air, and that's going to need a lot of clean electricity too. And when you put all that together, we may need to quadruple today's electric generation. And you just can't get there by piling up little things here and there. You need something that scales really fast. You need a kind of global policy on this and a paradigm shift, if you will, to producing clean electricity in really large quantities. So what we propose is that at the rate that Sweden built out, and it could be France or Ontario or other places too, but at the rate that countries have built out nuclear power, we could do this worldwide, building hundreds, literally at least 100 new nuclear reactors worldwide every year. Right now there are 400 in the world, so you're talking about a huge scale-up of the industry. That has other advantages too, because the costs will come down as it scales up. Right now, you know, like in the United States, we didn't build nuclear reactors for 30 years. And then we come along with some new design, and we're going to build the first of a kind ever of this new design. And however good the design is in theory, the cost overruns are just overwhelming when you try to do that on the first one off the line. But when you're building the 100th one of the same design, and you're building them centrally in factories or shipyards and sending them around the world to where they're needed, the costs are going to come down below coal, below natural gas, below everything. And that's what we need, because then that farmer in India can afford the electricity. And the government in Indonesia is going to say, we won't build a new coal plant, we'll build a nuclear plant because it's cheaper. So that's where we see this going. So the big scale up, looking at the big picture of where we need to go as a planet and not just little pieces here and there.
But even if everybody subscribed to what you're saying, the UN warns us that the tipping point is in just 12 years. How long does it take to even build nuclear power plants?
Well, yeah, it's so not that the...
It's a confusing issue to explain, because obviously it's very quick to put a solar panel on your roof and it's immediately going. And so it seems intuitively like that's quicker. But when you look at the amount of output that you get from these different power sources, as I said, the fastest way to add low carbon energy in history from data is nuclear. But every individual plant takes several years to build. It's just that when they come online, they produce as much power as many, many thousands of other sources, because they're usually large enough to do that.
Has Sweden also gotten fossil fuel free with its automobiles? Because, as Joshua pointed out, electric cars also require power, and nothing just comes without a problem. Meanwhile, automakers around the world are cutting back on the production of compacts, hybrids, and electric cars in favor of making more SUVs, because SUVs are what sell these days. How do you get the general public to recognize the role it has to play on a personal level?
Yeah, that's one of the sad failure stories of recent Sweden. And so we have absolutely not gotten nearly far enough with electric vehicle expansion.
Volvo is not making electric vehicles?
Not quickly enough, Saab. Not attractively enough. I mean, Norway has instituted, and this is easy for an extremely rich country to do, a system whereby electric cars are fairly cheap to buy. And so they're the world leader in electric cars, but that's kind of not a model that's easy to copy, because they're one of the richest countries in the world. But really what you need, one of the basic factors that you need to do this, to electrify a transport fleet, is to have a lot of reliable, clean electricity available. And so Sweden is unfortunately shutting down perfectly functional reactors. And so we are basically on the verge of losing the capacity to go electric for the transport system if these very unwise plans go forward. If you have a lot, let's say even a surplus of clean, reliable power available, that's one of the cornerstones of transitioning to electricity for the transport fleet.
Did you want to add to that, Joshua, or should I?
I wanted to say that we've talked a lot about Sweden, and that's one very important case, but there are other countries where similar things are going on. And
I mentioned France and parts of Canada, Korea.
Yeah, Toronto. You can go on a website called electricitymap.org, and they show how much carbon is being generated for each kilowatt hour of electricity produced for all the countries and a lot of sub-regions, regions within the United States, for instance. And they color code them, so you can see the green ones have very low emissions per kilowatt hour and the red ones higher. And you look at those green countries and see what they all have in common. They all are using one of two things. Either they have abundant hydropower, like Uruguay or somewhere, or they're using nuclear power, like Toronto, Sweden, France. And so it's very instructive. You can look for yourself and see places like Germany or California that claim to be climate leaders, or much less China, actually are a lot dirtier than the places that you might not have heard as much about. But it's because they're using nuclear power or hydro if they have it.
Now, I mentioned earlier that Margaret Thatcher called for a global treaty on climate change in 1988. Has Britain implemented anything that you would consider positive?
Yeah, I think they're taking many steps in the right direction. I mean, they have some very rational systems thinking going on in the UK. I currently live in the UK, so I know quite a lot about it. But they also have some irrational policies regarding biomass combustion, which I know you had a program about earlier. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but in terms of the European countries, it's one of the more rational and systems thinking approaches of any nation, actually.
Next spring, a group of Harvard University scientists will send balloons up into the atmosphere to seed calcium carbonate particles. into the air with the aim of seeing whether we can turn down the temperature of the Earth. What are your thoughts about geoengineering?
We think there should be research. Like to avoid it, yeah. If possible.
You think
there should be research on it, but the thing people need to understand is it's not the opposite of putting carbon up and causing global warming. It's a different process. You put it's like mimicking what a volcano does when sulfur particles go in the stratosphere, and it'll reflect some sunlight and cool the Earth, but it'll cool different places, and it may cause droughts one place and floods somewhere else, and it's sort of another layer of climate change, but moving in the other direction. So we're in favor of researching it, but it's no quick fix. It's not going to solve the problem for us. And it would have to be done very slowly over quite a number of decades, phasing up and then phasing back down again.
And another danger with that approach is if it is successful, if it's implemented and successful, it could lead, I think, to people not shutting down fossil fuel power as quickly as they would have otherwise. And so you still have all of the environmental damage that's not directly linked to warming, such as the million people dying and all of the other environmental problems that you have. And so we should, it's not a fix, it's more of a Band-Aid.
The basic idea is to seed the atmosphere with gases to block some of the sun's rays by reflecting them back into space, and by doing that, lowering the Earth's temperature. You mentioned it mimics the after effects of big volcanic explosions where gases released have caused global cooling.
Yeah, but then after a couple of years, that dissipates and you get back to normal. But this, you would have to keep doing it year after year, decade after decade, or else the whole effect of climate change would catch up with you. Also, the ocean acidification would not be helped at all by this. And it's just kind of an unknown effect, what it would do to the world's weather systems. We know that climate change is messing with weather systems.
We could keep it in the overall toolbox, but not look upon it as a solution, but rather as a kind of a dampening of symptoms of the illness. But now, I wouldn't discount its use.
Now, we are entering into a new political environment in the United States with changes in Congress. Joshua, do you see anything positive in this new group that's coming in terms of what your concerns are?
Well, one of the few things that both parties agree on is the need for clean energy innovation. And the Congress just passed by huge bipartisan margin a Nuclear Energy Innovation and Modernization Act, which I think is on Trump's desk now, or maybe he's signed. He's not against it. So this actually, having so much partisan rancor and gridlock, may make an incentive to work on clean energy, since it's one of the few things both parties agree on. That's my hope.
But there's also been a lot of talk about the power of the oil and gas lobbies. And I mentioned earlier new EPA rules in regard to mercury emissions. So are we sending out mixed signals here?
Well, yeah, they're not very mixed from the administration. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say anything good about the current administration regarding climate change. Certainly it's a step backward. But it's not like we were solving the problem before and now they've stopped it. It's like we were taking some little steps in the right direction. Now they've taken little steps in the wrong direction. It's not good, but I'm not convinced that it's kills off our ability to solve the problem. I think we can still solve the problem if we unite around what we do agree on.
Now, I'm not a kid anymore, so I won't be around in 2050. But unless there are major changes in the expansion of lifespans. But what's life going to be like if we just continue the way we're going now?
It's not going to be good. And the 2050 might be livable. The trouble is that by 2050, these tipping points begin to kick in the climate system. And you could trigger a new ice age, or you could trigger rapid sea level rise and these things in a way that might not manifest until 2080 or 2090 or 2100, but they would be unstoppable at that point. This is the really difficult thing about climate change. By the time you feel it, it's too late to do anything about it. And we're feeling it now a little bit, but it's really nothing compared with what's coming down the road. So it's not like if we make it to 2050, we're okay. We have to make it way past that.
Joshua S. Goldstein is Professor Emeritus of International Relations at American University. Staffan Ekqvist is a Swedish engineer, scientist, and consultant to clean energy projects around the world. Their book, A Bright Future, How Some Countries Have Solved Climate Change and the Rest Can Follow, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you. And we have a website at brightfuturebook.com if people want to learn more about it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Joshua Goldstein and Staffan Ekqvist, to Reggie Johnson, who's at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. You can also hear past shows streaming on demand at WBAI.org. We're available as an iTunes podcast. And don't forget to check out Leonard Lopate at Large on Facebook and Twitter, and our website, leonardlopateatlarge.com, where you will find links to all of our past shows. Stay tuned for Sojourn of Truth with Margaret Prescott, coming up at 2. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.
This is Ben Max, editor of Gotham Gazette and co-host of Max and Murphy with Jarrett Murphy of City Limits every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on WBAI Radio. Tune in this week as we dissect Governor Andrew Cuomo's third inaugural address and discuss his chances at running for the presidency, and we'll take your calls to discuss it all. And then, later in the show, we'll have State Assembly member Michael Blake join us. He's running for New York City public advocate in a crowded field ahead of a special election set to take place in February. Tune in for your politics show, 5 p.m. Wednesday on WBAI. It's Max and Murphy with you, your calls, your thoughts on politics in 2019 in New York.
Listener-sponsored WBAI is rebooting its morning show, Wake Up Call, weekday mornings, Monday through Friday. And we are looking for contributors from progressive communities all over our listening area. Our reach is vast, from Long Island, all the boroughs in New York City, to Westchester, to parts of New Jersey, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania. Areas where activism is part of daily life, where coalition building is the norm. While other stations have many producers working on a single program, our station depends on you, our listeners. If you are interested in being a contributor to Wake Up Call, please email wakeup@wbai.org. And thank you.
Hello, this is Kiani Bria, WBAI's local election supervisor, with an announcement. WBAI's local station board election will be held from January 7th to February 11th, 2019. For updates, visit WBAI.org, and for questions, you may call 413-424-9569 or email les_WBAI@pacifica.org.
The Universal Declaration of Human Rights is an outline of our human rights. That outline is elaborated in a series of declarations, treaties, and conventions adopted and signed by countries. For example, Article 7 of the Declaration states in part, "All are entitled to equal protection against any discrimination in violation of this declaration and against any incitement of such discrimination." This article has been elaborated into a number of declarations, conventions, and treaties, including the International Convention to End All Forms of Racial Discrimination, or CERD. CERD lays out the rights of individuals and groups to be free from racial discrimination as part of their human rights. CERD also lays out the obligations of countries to protect the rights of those individuals and groups against discrimination. The U.S. government is a signatory to CERD.
This is W.